Chief Justice, may it please the court, the district court's fundamental error in this case was by proceeding beyond a threshold analysis of whether the appellee's theories under either federal or state law stated a viable cause of action on their theory that as two currently incarcerated inmates, they're entitled to have the state of Nebraska affirmatively facilitate their wedding ceremony by video conference. In doing so, the court proceeded directly to merits considerations that it should not have reached, and in issuing its order on the cross motions for summary judgment, violated the state's sovereign immunity and improperly awarded federal equitable relief against not officials in their official capacity, consistent with Ex parte Young, but against individuals in their personal capacity, which affords them no relief. For those reasons and for the others that we've set forth in our brief, the order and decision on the cross motions for summary judgment should be reversed, and this court should order dismissal of the claim.
Counsel, is this a final appealable order at this point?
Yes, and the issue on that is one that you've seen before. It's been described in the Murray versus Stein case, in the Olson versus Pelagi case. The issue is whether a request for fees has been made before the judgment deciding the final order has been issued. If it's there and it's a separate motion, then there's still a matter pending, so it's not a final appeal order.
Okay, in this case, it was set forth in the amended petition for prayer for relief.
Correct. But that wasn't a separate motion.
Right.
So this case is like Olson.
What impact does the court's ruling ordering cost in its original judgment have? Does that have any impact on this?
I don't think so, because you have to remember, given the absence of the separate motion requesting fees, consistent with basically the same scenario that the court dealt with in Olson, the decision on the merits constituted a final appeal order. The separate motion to request fees didn't come in until after that was made, and then when we filed our appeal, it terminated the district court's jurisdiction.
Do costs equate to attorney's fees?
They would, but you still have to have some kind of separate motion beforehand, indicating to be consistent with what this court said in Murray and Olson before, to leave some kind of issue to be determined such that final merits order is not a final appeal order. So yes, as we've, and I know we went through some extra briefing on this at the jurisdictional screen, but I'm confident that the I believe it was the February 3rd order on the cross motions for summary judgment was final appeal. Turning to the merits, I'll focus on our state law claims first before turning to the federal law claims. Regarding the appellee's 84-911 APA claim, it's about as straightforward as an issue as they come. They dropped the department as a named party. 84-911 explicitly requires the department to be a party to the action. At that juncture, the APA claim was dead. There simply cannot be an APA claim against individual citizens, basically, in their personal capacities. There's no official capacity there. There's no state authority imbued within people in their individual capacity. And that's all beyond the fact that the statute itself requires that the department be a party. Even if the court were to proceed beyond that, there are two other reasons why we still have to prevail. One, it's another threshold consideration. They haven't challenged the validity of a rule or regulation, which is another explicit requirement of 84-911 for that type of an APA claim. In fact, in their brief on appeal, they expressly acknowledge that what they're trying to do is get the department to comply with what they believe is an administrative regulation that works out for them. That doesn't matter, since it further undercuts the notion that they could have a viable 84-911 case because they're conceding that they're not challenging the validity of a rule or regulation. And alternatively, still, even if the court were to proceed beyond that, what they're asking for is a compelled affirmative act, which this court has repeatedly said would violate the state's sovereign immunity. The compelled affirmative act here would be forcing the state through an equitable remedy to affirmatively facilitate a marriage ceremony by video conference. Putting aside the merits of what other federal right there might be for inmate marriage, the particular relief they're requesting in this case is undoubtedly an affirmative act. So unless the court has any further questions on the state law issues, I think the resolution of the APA issue is extraordinarily straightforward here. Given my first point regarding the dropping of the Department of Correctional Services as a party, that's a choice they made, and it totally destroys the APA.
As a matter of statutory interpretation, under 42-109, can a marriage be solemnized by video conference?
Justice Castle, I'm going to politely try to dodge your question.
All right.
Here's why. I have every expectation that this particular case, given the way it's been designated, should fall by the wayside. I have every expectation that these inmates, represented by my friends, will be back before us with similar claims. And I'd like to keep my powder dry for a record to be developed on properly designated claims as to what obligations we have, the department has, in facilitating an inmate marriage, with the wrinkle being not simply an inmate marriage to someone on the outside, which they undoubtedly have a right to, not an absolute one under Turner versus Safley, but a right to it. With this case where you have two currently incarcerated inmates in two different facilities, I think there's the sneak preview of my answer is that I think they have a pretty tough row to hoe on the notion that presence could mean video conference.
And does that ultimate issue have implications beyond prisoners as to anybody who's being married under the statutes of the state of Nebraska?
Certainly could, because the Chapter 42 statute on presence is not inmate-specific. That's a generally applicable statute well beyond the correctional setting, which is again, the court doesn't need to reach this, but that's one that properly comes before the court, is one that needs to be explored with its full potential ramifications.
Thank you. I won't make you lose any more of your time.
Thank you.
Counsel, how about the individual capacity of the named defendants?
Regarding the federal claims?
Well,
okay.
Regarding the entirety of the case.
Well, it doesn't work for either one. If you look at the Lautenbach case, the Johnson versus Clark case, any number of other cases where equitable relief is being sought against state officers requires official capacity. And I can sort of conclude before I reserve by saying the same rules apply for the equitable claims on the 1983 side. And the case, I know I cited a number of cases in the brief for this. The one I'd focus the court's attention on is the District of Columbia's decision in Hatfield. It gives a very broad overview of the need and the rationale for ex parte Young relief being sought against a state official in their official capacity. As the Supreme Court, the U.S. Supreme Court said in Kentucky versus Graham, 1-0 to get equitable relief against a official in their personal capacity, shorn of their state authority. So there's just simply not a viable cause of action there for federal claims, to say nothing of the fact that even if they could get past that threshold determination, there's not a clearly established federal constitutional right for two inmates to be married when they're currently incarcerated. Draw a line from Loving through Zablocki, through Turner versus Safley to Obergefell. There's not a lot of daylight for us to say no to inmate marriage generally, or the right to marriage generally, but the right asserted here is narrower and is specific to two currently incarcerated inmates.
Why is this right narrower?
Well,
just because of location where they're being housed?
Well, yes. The fact that they are currently currently incarcerated inmates is different from the right set out in Turner versus Safley, if I can finish, where the inmate to be married was going to be married to someone on the outside. Again, it relates to Justice Castle's previous question on the Chapter 42 issue.
Doesn't it go to a penological interest and the safety of the facility and the inmates and things of that nature versus just physical locality?
That is the analysis you would have to get to under Turner versus Safley if you got there. But you would first have to determine as a threshold matter that there's a burdening on an inmate's right. Undoubtedly, it would be a burden on an inmate's right if we're talking about them trying to marry somebody on the outside. What is unclear to me at this stage is where there is a clearly established federal constitutional right, given that the proposed spouse, fiance, is also incarcerated.
So that's your definition of the clearly established right that's on deck. Two inmates, both housed.
If they have it. I don't know. I'm not prepared to concede that they even have that right. And that would be the threshold issue the court would have to reach before you proceeded to the Turner versus Safley analysis.
You have a constitutional right to marry. You
absolutely
agree with that.
Yes.
And you acknowledge that.
Yes.
So what's the difference of two inmates being housed? Why is their right different constitutionally?
Well, it...
Doesn't it go to the safety of the facility? Doesn't it go to the safety of the inmates?
It could.
Are there issues in that nature versus just a fact that they're housed inmates?
Well, the purported right here is not simply right to marry as was delineated in the Turner versus Safley case. Even if we proceeded beyond that threshold question, yes, those are exactly the considerations the court would need to account for in determining whether the burden that's been placed on the right, to the extent it's a right, and for purpose of the conversation, I'm happy to sort of say, let's assume it's a right, and then we would proceed to that analysis. You would then conduct that analysis based on a record that really hasn't been developed in this case, so it's not ripe for any kind of adjudication.
The last issue then is the compelling and affirmative act, that being the setting up of the Skype to put these two people into the communication, live communication. Is that
the
affirmative act that we're talking about being compelled?
That's what the district court characterized the relief that they're seeking as being. And I think, you know, again, that's three levels down on the APA side from the threshold determination of not having the right party designated. But even if you got there, I think, you know, setting up a video conference and the funds that would take to put that in place, to the extent they don't already have some kind of system in place to facilitate that now, that's the definition of a compelled affirmative act that would violate the state's sovereign immunity. So even if you must go that deep on the APA side, it sovereign immunity bars the claim. If there are any other questions, I've asked for reversal. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Mr. Gooch, good morning to you.
Good morning, Your Honor. Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the court, my name is Michael Gooch. I'm here on behalf of two inmates who seek to get married. And I'd like to comment that marriage is not necessarily limited to procreation or to physical contact. It can be that relationship that causes you to get up every morning with hope. And that's why, for those of you who are going, gee, why do these people who are facing long prison sentences in different facilities want to marry? For the same reason anyone else wants to marry, except removing the making babies. Scope of review here is there are no disputed facts, so there's nothing for you to have to change or wrestle with there. The law is de novo before you, as you well know. which we submit leads to the fundamental question of whether or not, as a constitutional first step, there's a right here. We submit that there is. And parenthetically, the state of Nebraska, represented by the Attorney General's office, says, I don't know. The Department of Correctional Services says there absolutely is, because if you look at Administrative Regulation 208.01 2D3B, it says, if both parties to the marriage are inmates, each inmate must submit a, et cetera, et cetera. Now, how could the state not say then that it is reasonable to anticipate that some inmates may develop a relationship with other inmates, which is problematic if you're talking about genealogical concerns, but not otherwise. But here the state's administrative regulation, the department itself, not a party here, says inmates can marry inmates. All they have to do is follow the rules, which these folks did. So there's no procedural problem getting to the merits.
But does that equate to a constitutional right?
Well, the answer to that is, I think not. I don't think that the mere fact that the state of Nebraska has recognized that the concept of marriage may extend beyond the traditional view of a man and a woman, neither of whom are confined, to a situation where one or both are unavailable to be in the same place at the same time. The service person who wants to marry, even though they're defending the country somewhere else, are we going to say, no, that's not a legitimate marriage because the technology allows that to happen? This whole issue, the trial judge resolved all that. And by the way, that's another thing that's kind of interesting, and I want to focus on it just for a moment, and that is, I'd kind of like to talk about what the trial judge did. Because the trial judge said, there's a constitutional right, that the U.S. Supreme Court in Turner versus Safley provided a useful framework for analyzing whether or not that framework establishes a constitutional right. Because clearly it may be a fundamental right where the state is not confining one or both of the people wishing to marry. But when they're in prison, we concede that the right is not absolute. Fundamental, yes. Absolute, no. And the U.S. Supreme Court has said, well, how do you analyze that? You give a healthy dose of respect to the institution that has them in its custody, so long as they measure that decision by institutional needs, by genealogical needs.
What do you think is... What do you think appellants are saying as to how the trial judge erred?
I think what they're...
They get that far?
I have to be very careful because I've known Mr. Lopez for a long time. I'm a fine lawyer and a man of integrity. This feels to me like we never want to talk about inmates being allowed to raise constitutional claims, no matter how clear they are, no matter how much that inmate may in fact have obeyed the rules for asking for something from their captors. Now, I understand that sentiment, and I don't think it's fair to ask this court
that,
to
that
go
could
down
be a broader driving impulse, but in this case, how do you read the appellant's focus as to what does appellant say trial judge did wrong?
I think the appellants are saying, one, the trial judge didn't reject the state law claims of declaratory judgment. Well, the trial judge did, in fact, reject those claims because he made no ruling on those issues. So consequently, is there an APA ruling in the trial judge's opinion? The answer is no. No, which, by the way, resolves the question of where's the state in all this.
Because that issue was limited to the APA framework?
Correct.
Thank you.
And it's ironic when you think about it. Are Mr. Gilpatrick and Ms. Weatherall complaining that the statute is unconstitutional? No. They've never said that. What happened is the defendant said, wait, our reason for not saying you can get married is because we have conjured up a challenge to the statute. All the trial judge said is, I'm unpersuaded. if you look at it as a Turner factor analysis, which is how the trial judge did it, perfectly sensible of that's not a penological justification for saying no. With respect to the regulations, shouldn't the department be involved there? What would be the point? Have the trial judge say, hey, you guys did a good job. Your regulations are consistent with the Constitution. That is, there's a right to marry, repeatedly referred to in the regulation. And it is limited, not absolute, to penological justifications, which they set out. You know, if it has an impact on threat to security or the order of the institution or to public safety, by all means, make an institutional decision. But where the defendants here don't want to get into the merits, it's because they said, we don't have any of that. They conceded that there's no threat to security or potential disruption to an institution. There's no issue about public safety. They just say, we don't have any of that. We still don't want to let you get married. And here's our laundry list of things that we would rather the court think about instead of the Constitution
of
the United States.
Well, isn't there argument that they would have to do something affirmative in this case? They would either have to move one of the inmates or they would have to set up a video conferencing system, which, candidly, is that allowable in Nebraska?
Here's the irony of that, Your Honor. First, if they had to transport an inmate, that certainly invokes issues of security or threat to public safety. Not moving them, still no issue there. With respect to the question of setting up the Skype system, that already exists. That's, if you look at footnote 3 of the court's opinion, the court talks about it. In fact, it's ironic, thank you, it's ironic again that the court allows inmates to be arraigned when they're told what the charges are by video conference.
So you would say that the record is undisputed, is that right?
Yes,
that,
ma'am.
That the video conferencing facility already exists.
And is in use by all of these facilities, but certainly by the penitentiary and by the Nebraska Center for Women.
Mr. Gooch, would you like to take a crack at my question about the meaning of 42-109, particularly in light of the history of that statute that said presence since 1867?
Your Honor, I will answer any question put to me by anyone on this court. And in respect to that, it strikes me that words mean things in context.
Not to put words in your mouth, but in this context, would you agree with me the legislature in 1867 could not have contemplated video conferences?
I think they could not have contemplated video conferences.
So then we're back to the question of statutory interpretation is, does the language somehow change with technology, or does it mean what the statute giver thought it meant in 1867? Isn't that the heart of that question?
I don't think it's quite that way. I don't, respectfully. I think that you regulate...
Of course, you're taking on Blackstone, you understand.
No, I know. I understand that. But, you know, believe it or not, this debate about originalism versus evolving standards of justice is not new. It's not new to this court any more than it is to any other. You know, it used to be that we thought that marriage was one man and one woman. The Supreme Court said, no, we're 200 years from there. And in Nebraska, we're well past inserting the word physical
now,
into the statute.
The evolution of that you mentioned was an equal protection. Here, the interpretation of the statute that presence means physical presence applies to everyone. There is no equal protection issue, is there?
This statute doesn't say physical presence.
Only
the appellants say
presence. It says presence.
Sure. Does that mean if you love someone and they're in the other room, they're not physically loved? They're not loved?
Well, I guess we can agree to to disagree on this.
I'm sure we can. I just don't think that it's appropriate to allow a party to insert words into a statute and then complain that somehow those...
So, like by video conference? I mean, it seems to me you all are the one that want to insert words into that statute. Presence has meant what it's meant for over 100 years.
We want to use the technology that exists today. It's like if someone has a broken leg, do we now take them to the hospital and get an x-ray, or do we just palpate the broken leg?
Would this state recognize the marriage between two parties, one of whom was serving in the armed forces in Iraq, and the other party was in the hospital about to deliver the baby of the two couples? And there were marriage officials present to perform the ceremony. Would this court recognize that marriage?
I hesitate to speculate about whether the state would buy that, conceding that occasionally consistency is the hobgoblin of little minds as opposed to otherwise. I don't know, but they should. The constitutional concept of presence is satisfied in both situations. The object of insisting that a person make a vow in front of a person licensed to note that vow, that should be respected. And the fact that technology allows it to be done in a slightly different manner, without any, by the way, additional affirmative contributions.
What do you think is the basis for what appears to be accepted that... A defendant can appear for arraignment with a video conference. What is the basis of that? Is that regulations, statutes?
The court.
Why is that okay?
My understanding. Well, first, there's a footnote in the court's opinion, footnote 3, that talks about it. My understanding is that basically the court administrator worked out a deal with the various custodians of people in jail and said, sit them in front of your video machine. We're going to do this that way.
You're not telling us that there is no statute expressly authorizing video conferences and criminal arraignments.
I simply don't know off the top of my head.
If I tell you that there is, does that affect your argument?
Well, the lawsuit wasn't brought as an equal protection argument, but it makes no sense, if you go back to the Turner factors, not to consider whether there are alternative ways of vindicating the constitutional right. That's a Turner factor. And here one exists with no additional expense or inconvenience to the state. It's hard to understand why that wouldn't weigh heavily in favor of Mr. Gilpatrick and Ms. Weatherall.
Okay. Well, I was wanting to talk about statutory interpretation. You're wanting to talk about the Constitution. That's fine. Thank you.
And
counsel, is your claim based solely on the Constitution and no statutory authority? Because I've not heard you mention a statute. It's solely a constitutional claim on your part.
Well, I actually thought I was answering the question about whether the statute already authorizes this type of marriage. Our position is that presence can include technological presence.
Okay.
We don't think you need to insert any words into the statute to accomplish that.
So it's more than just a constitutional claim?
It is that there's nothing in the statute that prohibits the constitutional
claim. Well, the court ordered the parties to be enjoined from enforcing 42-109 or requiring a physical presence with regard to the marriage.
I'm sorry, I missed
the court enjoined the parties from enforcing 42-109, from requiring a physical presence or denying the marriage by video conference. So the statute in play is 42-109.
Yes, Your Honor, that much I think.
And your constitutional argument is based upon equal protection, and that 42-109 somehow would violate equal protection and therefore it shouldn't be enforced in these circumstances.
Except that the court's order that we're talking about has an or.
Right. Or denying them marriage by video conference.
Right.
Yeah. Okay.
Counsel, I have one more question for you. On the issue of the state law claim, are you now acknowledging that that was denied by the district court and failing to rule on it?
I'm not sure that failing to rule on it means he rejected it. Because in his conclusion, he does say that the defendants are enjoined from enforcing their policy.
So that's my next question. That is, under the federal law claim, the 1983 action, can you enjoin an individual in their individual capacity? They're employees of the Department of Corrections. Can you enjoin them? And then if you do enjoin them from or some injunctive relief, what's the effect of that? And Mr. Kenny no longer works for the Department of Corrections. I don't know if these two other individual defendants work for the department. What impact does that have on the department in itself?
Well, ultimately, in a case where we're not asking the department to really do anything except stop saying no.
You're asking somebody to do something, aren't you? I mean, somebody's got to do something to make this happen. If nobody does anything, the marriage doesn't occur. So somebody has to do something to put them in a room with the Skype or something in that way to make this connection so that the marriage could be solemnized. Is that correct?
I think so. I think that's a fair description of
so who's
doing
enjoined?
Something, but that's not a reasonable understanding of your rule about a state cannot be required to, the state cannot be required to take an affirmative step. Certainly the state can be required to take an affirmative step to stop violating the Constitution. And that is true
state,
of
individual capacity.
But that is true of individuals.
Aren't there money damages for those individuals if they violate a constitutional right? Can't they be held for money damages in a 1983 action?
Well, this is not the time or place to talk about the legitimacy of the claim that money damages are available in light of the extraordinary breadth of the good faith immunity doctrine. It's enough to say
qualified immunity.
That no person working clothed in state power should be viewed as immune from the authority of the court when the court says, stop breaking the law. That's just simple.
Is there case law to support that?
Well, I think so. I mean, I cite some in my brief. Parenthetically, this argument about you can't enjoin people who are sued individually, you'll note they're all federal cases. They're all cases which appear, when you look at them, to be solely a matter of courts restraining its power and really not a matter of constitutional limitation. If you go back and look at N. Ray Young, it doesn't say that. It's the courts later saying, well, you know, we're worried because maybe we won't have a live plaintiff by the time we get around to doing it. But here you do. Here these people should be allowed to get married.
I think Justice Funk's questions may be going to whether or not you have an active defendant, or can the defendants moot the matter.
You know, that's been the most disturbing thing about this whole thing, Judge. The truth of the matter is, their regulations say there's no justification. They don't even pretend there's a reason to say no. They say, maybe it's a constitutional right, but because it's two inmates, maybe it's not, you know. But it doesn't make any difference to us, because you can't tell us to let them get married, to allow them to do this. They have to bring their own preacher. We're okay with that. You have to get your own marriage certificate. We're okay with that. We'll bring the flowers. We're not asking them to do anything but use equipment that's already there, already functioning. I believe I may have just barely gone past my... Thank you very much.
I believe you have too. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
We will go on to the next case of the day, which is Heckman versus Markio.